watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us or WMRW Warren. I'm Lynn Gary, and this is Unwelcome Guests. The new year is one of those markers in time that causes people to reflect on the past, assess the present, and make decisions and predictions about the future. So I gave a bit of thought as to what to play for you on this, the first episode of Unwelcome Guests of the new year. At this time of year, there tend to be a number of media offerings looking back on the important events of the previous year, which I guess are supposed to give us a bearing on where we've been and thus, presumably, where we are. I decided that to understand where we are, we'd better go back about 500 years to the birth of a civilization that redefined the pursuit of happiness in what turned out to be a monumentally destructive and toxic way. So this week, we begin a series of bi-monthly lectures and discussions with Professor John Marciano, which are from a public class that meets to read and discuss Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. But I'd first like to read you an essay that examines the way we define success and happiness societally, the consequences of our ideas about progress, and a vision for a new way of going forward that we might, and one might say must, take. This piece has a title which doesn't do justice to its contents. It's called Papa Smurf, and the author is Alexander Zaychuk. It was written in late October of 2005. Zaychuk writes, "The New York Times recently reported on a curious conference held in Nova Scotia. The powwow brought together economists, social scientists, CEOs, and government officials to inquire into the sources of human happiness and why there seemed to be a shortfall of this precious product in so many countries. Discussion focused on how governments might quantify and increase this contentment once its elements were isolated and some sort of formula worked out. Participants all shared the assumption that the metrics of traditional economics, GDP, rates of growth and employment, were useless in gauging well-being. In determining quality of life, as opposed to mere standard of living, they agreed that the usual stats hid as much as they revealed about a society. The star of the conference was thus the only current government attempt at such a project. The Gross National Happiness Index maintained by the Buddhist Kingdom of Bhutan, which was heavily and happily represented in Nova Scotia. The idea of a Gross National Happiness Index, of measuring such economic externalities as a healthy environment, time spent with family, enjoyment of work, quality health care, spiritual life, is, as the Times writer pointed out, straight from the playbook of the German-born British economist and social critic E.F. Schumacher, most famous for his best-selling 1973 book, Small is Beautiful, Economics as if People Mattered. The lack of such human-centered statistics as a Gross National Happiness Index was just one piece of evidence presented in Schumacher's case against classical economics and industrial consumer society. It was a critique that drew from a long tradition of European social criticism, some of it utopian, some not, from Charles Fourier to the young Marx to Richard Taney. Schumacher's twist was to add equal parts Buddha, Aquinas, and William Morris, resulting in a sweet-smelling recipe whose countercultural vapors eventually snaked their way through the windows of editorial boards academic departments, and the world's most powerful financial institutions. Happiness, and crucially survival, could only be ours, argued Schumacher, if we abandon the blueprint that has led us to a gigantic turbine of global consumption and growth for growth's sake. We must move beyond a worldview that values quantification without qualification, in the words of Lewis Mumford, one of Schumacher's intellectual godfathers. If Bhutan's gross national happiness index is right out of small as beautiful, conferences like the one in Nova Scotia are themselves right out of the era of Schumacher's peak influence, namely the mid to late 1970s. It is perhaps no coincidence that interest in Schumacherian ideas seems to be emerging from the margins just as talk of looming permanent oil shock gets louder. For while E.F. Schumacher's assault on the traditional economics is at heart a humanist spiritual one, its urgency and appeal have always shared their roots with harder stuff. Small is Beautiful proposes a scaled-down, resource-thrifty version of modernity, not just because the author thought we'd all be happier, much, but because he felt it would be eventually forced upon us anyway, the result of a forceful revelation Schumacher had in the 1950s. While chief economist at the British National Coal Board studying the energy consumption patterns of Western Europe, it occurred to Schumacher that the obsession with growth that was a religion of both the Western and Eastern blocs failed to take into account the finite resource base upon which their economies rested. As his peers all proudly proclaimed a golden age of never-ending growth, Schumacher found himself doubting the dominant sense of optimism engendered by the swift recovery of the continent after the war. Alarmed by the glibness with which planners took natural resources for granted, he told an uninterested audience of professional economists in 1954, "We are living off capital in the most fundamental meaning of the word. Only in the last 100 years has man forcibly broken into nature's larder and is now emptying it at breathtaking speed." The problem of production has not been solved, he warned, because modern production in anything like its current form would not be possible in 100 years, possibly much sooner. He concluded that the current arrangement could not last, was indeed insane. Before the phrase existed, Schumacher began to publicly explore what sustainable development might look like. For 2 decades, Schumacher tried to tap his profession on the shoulder to little effect. He continued to hone his vision of a more modest, spiritually centered, ecologically sensitive society in the smaller journals on both sides of the Atlantic, eventually including his own quarterly Bible of alternative economics, Resurgence, the Journal of the Fourth World. His following grew during the 1960s, but despite the sudden glut of paperbacks examining affluence and its discontents, it wasn't yet Schumacher's moment. Though his vision was aligned with most of what Paul Goodman, Eric Fromm, and other 60s celebrity humanists were saying, there was still little market for Schumacher's elegant, avuncular warnings over the suicidal contradictions of a consumer civilization. There was even less general interest in his detailed ideas for what the tools and shape of an alternative society should look like, in the West anyway. More than one government in the developing world sought his advice. Then came the 1973 oil shock. "The party's over," Schumacher immediately declared, sensing the opening OPEC had created. He was not alone in thinking the politically triggered crisis would result in profound and permanent change in the way we produced and consumed, lived and traveled. He was in more limited company in thinking this to be a good thing. As it happened, the oil shock and the worried conversations it sparked occurred almost simultaneously with the publication of Small is Beautiful, Schumacher's first book. The timing could not have been more perfect. And before the first Pintos rolled off the Ford assembly line, its author would be famous around the world as the man with a post-party plan. With the oil shock as backdrop, Small is Beautiful's attention to finite natural resources dovetailed with the buzz created by Paul Ehrlich's best-selling doomsday prophecy, The Population Bomb, as well as 1973's equally pessimistic Club of Rome report, The Limits of Growth. 3 years after the celebration of the first Earth Day, everyone, it seemed, was talking about the possibility that an overpopulated planet based on industrial consumerism was cruising toward an iceberg. Growth might just be another god that failed. With third world development, another hot topic, Schumacher's time had arrived. Surely the world would have no choice but to begin a thoughtful shift toward less energy-intensive local production and scaled-down consumption, to use technologies more appropriate to the size of man and within the reach of more of them, and to begin the inevitable switch toward energy sources that neither polluted nor ran out. Alas, Schumacher's party's over prediction was premature. So too the dire warnings of Ehrlich and the Club of Rome, which predicted a global population of 20 billion and the collapse of a mineral-depleted civilization by 2000, respectively. After a swift rise to celebrity and influence that included standing-room-only speaking tours and visits to both Jimmy Carter's White House and World Bank headquarters, the 1980s would see a return of cheap oil, a passing of the sense of crisis, and a remarginalization of Schumacher's ideas. The man himself died of heart failure in 1977, age 66. 32 years after the publication of Small is Beautiful, the world faces a prospect of a permanent oil shock to make the jolts of the 1970s seem like ripples in a pond. Analysts are warning that the party might soon be over, and it does seem increasingly fantastical that cheap, plentiful oil will return on the wings of Caspian Basin or Iraqi output. Even if surprise sources of crude do come online, surging global demand guarantees that there will not be another quiet disappearance of the energy question from the front pages anytime soon. If the more pessimistic time frame predictions come to pass, new fuels and renewables will lack both the capacity and infrastructure to stave off a severe breakdown of the global economy in its current form. Just as he did 32 years ago, E.F. Schumacher has much to say about how we might approach an energy crisis, which is also a civilizational crisis, and hence a civilizational opportunity. Schumacher thought the answer to man's spiritual and ecological crisis lay in what he called intermediate technology, energy-light, human-sized technology controlled by man instead of vice versa, technology that would find reflection in smaller, self-sufficient human organization at every level. Simpler and cheaper, intermediate technology is superior to primitive industrial technology because it is democratic or people's technology. In Schumacher's ideal new communities powered by intermediate technology, hierarchies would be relatively flat, allowing for control, empowerment, and greater equality. To pick just one example in the developing world, intermediate technologies such as drip irrigation and foot-operated treadle pumps have displaced massive irrigation projects to enormous success. The Intermediate Technology Development Group, newly renamed Practical Action, continues to develop this idea around the world, from clean water to electricity production. And I'm reading from an article titled Papa Smurf by Alexander Zaitchik. Continuing. In the developed world, Schumacher's interest in decentralization is currently finding reflection in a number of post-9/11 corporate and community initiatives to decouple themselves from a fragile and vulnerable centralized energy grid powered exclusively by fossil fuels. These efforts may not be heralds of a gleaming bioregionalist future, as Schumacher imagined it, but they are auspicious signs of change in the right direction. Schumacher, at his dreamiest, wrote, quote, "I have no doubt that it is possible to give a new direction to technological development, a direction that shall lead it back to the real needs of man, but that also means to the actual size of man. Man is small, and therefore small is beautiful. To go for giantism is to go for self-destruction. And what is the cost of a reorientation? We might remind ourselves that to calculate the cost of survival is perverse. No doubt a price has to be paid for anything worthwhile. To redirect technology so that it serves man instead of destroying him requires primarily an effort of the imagination and an abandonment of fear. Close quote. Against and above the doomsday crowd, Schumacher speaks to us through his books, the organizations that work in his name, and the work of thousands he influenced. These thousands include many of those laboring hardest to make sure our post-party plans are up to date and at hand. Such spawn includes influential energy theorists, consultants like Amory Lovins and Bruce Piasecki, two important Schumacherians with both feet in mainstream policy debates. E.F. Schumacher helped me to choose my battles and arguments. He set the table upon which many of us still feast, says Piasecki, founder and president of the forward-thinking American Hazard Control Group. Ernst Friedrich Schumacher was born in 1911 in Bonn, Germany, the son of a well-known economist. At 18, he left for Oxford, where he took to his father's discipline with precocity. At 23, he was appointed a lecturer of finance at Columbia University, the youngest on faculty, leaving the post only to join the inner circle of John Maynard Keynes. During World War II, Schumacher was briefly interned on a farm in England, during which time he developed a fondness for manual labor, kept a rigorous meditation regimen, and began to read widely the study of comparative religion. After the war, he was given a senior position in the Allied government overseeing the reconstruction of West Germany. Throughout the first stages of his career, Schumacher remained attached to the orthodoxies of his era: mixed economy, growth, balance of trade. Despite his personal idiosyncrasies and private search for the non-economic meaning of life, there was little in Schumacher's work to suggest a radical future. Schumacher's mature philosophy would find full flower in 1955, soon after his revelation at the National Coal Board. Invited by the government of Burma to help craft that poor nation's development plan, Schumacher fell in love with the Burmese and their Buddhist culture. He could not in good conscience provide his hosts with a standard modernization formula of heavy industry and export-oriented production, as did his fellow advisors. He urged them instead to follow a middle path consistent with Buddhist principles and Burmese culture, and to develop in a way mindful of the size and scope of the traditional village, the only important social structure for most of the country. In making these recommendations, which the Burmese government took to heart, Schumacher did not think he was condemning a nation to poverty and misery. Since the industrialized West was not the happiest place in the world, and since in any case it was headed for an ecological reckoning, Schumacher saw in the Third World a laboratory for a better way, one defined by the development and use of intermediate technology for the local production of goods to be consumed locally. He called this Buddhist economics. As he explained in Small is Beautiful, production from local resources for local needs is the most rational way of economic life. While dependence on imports from afar and the consequent need to produce the export to unknown and distant peoples is highly uneconomic and justifiable only in exceptional cases and on a small scale. Just as the modern economist would admit that a high rate of consumption of transport services between a man's home and his place of work signifies a misfortune and not a high standard of life, so the Buddhist would hold that to satisfy human wants from faraway sources rather than from sources nearby signifies failure rather than success. Unquote. In an age of cheap and stable levels of carbon in the atmosphere, this might be written off as soft-headed, if not utopian. In an age of peak oil and rapid climate change, it lays a strong claim to the mantle of common sense. Though Schumacher's economics is fueled by a spiritual furnace, One needn't fully buy into his pseudo-Gandhian fusing of economics and religion to appreciate its relevance. The current regime of energy-intensive global trade, of Chinese trinkets and Honduran fruit in Oklahoman Walmarts, is based on an energy reality that is quickly passing into history. It may be that small will only be embraced as beautiful when it becomes necessary. Consider food. According to the World Policy Institute, the U.S. food system uses as much energy as the total annual energy consumption of France. But the actual growing of food accounts for only 20% of this energy. The other 80% is used to move, process, package, sell, and store the food after it leaves the farm. The U.S. Organic Consumers Association estimates that the average item of food travels 1,600 miles from farm to fork, while processed foods travel an average of 3,600 miles from farm to fork. As the cost of the fuel needed to power refrigerated trucks and jumbo jets that bring food across continents goes into orbit and stays there, the increase in transportation costs will be reflected in markets across America. Even if non-fossil fuel-based gasolines are eventually developed, most of the leading candidates are based on grains and syrups, so in a way we will still be choosing between food and transportation if we insist on sending food around the world. Local, small-scale food production also allows for more use of non-petrochemical fertilizers. Schumacher wasn't just concerned that we use less energy, but where we got it and how we distributed it. In an age of mega-terrorism and freakish storms, the argument against a centralized energy system is self-evident, and indeed the market for microturbines to produce and distribute clean energy is growing. One hopes that the intellectual market for Schumacher's ideas is also set to grow. In the coming years, we are likely to see a lot of prophets stepping forward, claiming to hold answers to the big questions now opening up before us and threatening to separate us from any future worth having. In E.F. Schumacher, we have a prophet ready-made, whose ideas have been test-driven by 3 decades of history and continuously honed by scores of realistic and highly intelligent practitioner followers. Not everything Schumacher has to say will please everyone, but we could do worse than to accept his challenge and ask ourselves anew what exactly an economy is good for, where it leads, what it is meant to serve, and who and how. For reasons that Schumacher himself predicted 50 years ago, small looks set to become beautiful again. This time, it may stick. And that was an essay by Alexander Zaitchik titled Papa Smurf, published at the end of last October.
Back in 1993, we all heard what the madman said. And they arrived in Texas camouflage with helicopters overhead. In through the window started shooting at the dogs. Then they burned the whole place down. That's an all-American dialogue. We all saw tapped on. Questions or subjects, people in 2003. Someone still insisting that the world is full of enemies. But it's only us folks, and there's no problem that can't be solved. Speak your mind and I'll speak mine, and that's what we call dialogue. Dialogue.
Here's Woodward, American Dialogue. Last spring and summer, we played a series of public classes by political economist Doug Dowd, which many people wrote to say they appreciated. For the new year, we're going to begin a series on American history, something which, if you had an education like mine, you would have learned almost nothing about, or at least nothing that was meaningful, and much that was false, or at best, propaganda. In my high school American history class, a so-called teacher, who was basically a phys ed instructor, stood up in front of the class and read a chapter from The Miserable Piece of Lies, which passed as a textbook, and we were then quizzed each Friday. The contents of the textbook were a procession of wars, which were always good, presidents who were making wars, inventors of profitable technology and how that was progress, and other boring and self-serving American state propaganda. They teach us this garbage because the purpose of school is to turn out obedient workers and soldiers, aka law-abiding citizens, ready to accept circumscribed life possibilities by basking in the reflected glory of being part of such a great and powerful country. The ideology we were indoctrinated into, and its spread and implementation throughout the globe, has led us to where we are. To understand how to get to the free and benevolent society we were told we had but don't have, it's important to understand that the grotesque programs of the Bush administration and their pals in Congress and on the courts are not some new development, but are part of an unbroken string of similar actions by a plutocracy that came to this land for profit and has pursued it over millions of dead bodies ever since. Our teacher will be John Marciano, a retired professor from SUNY Cortland who now lives in Southern California, where he runs a free discussion group for the public. His text for the course is A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. The students read the chapter at home, and Marciano's lectures take off from the material read in Zinn. You need not have read the book to enjoy or understand the lectures, though, of course, reading A People's History of the United States is eminently worthwhile for its own sake. This week, we begin at the beginning with the arrival of Christopher Columbus.
This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is part one of chapter one, which contains John's commentary from his talk on April 26th, 2005.
I'm approaching these comments tonight, or these remarks, these critical remarks about Christopher Columbus, this powerful, important figure in this chapter, with a great deal of trepidation, because I was born in Columbus Hospital on East 19th Street in New York City. It's now known as the Cabrini Medical Center. It was named for an Italian immigrant nun who cared for people in that area of New York City. But I think as historians, as scholars, students, we have to follow the evidence. Given what I will say about Columbus, I guess I'm just the bearer of bad news. Columbus profoundly influenced two phenomena that transformed the modern world, especially in the Americas. One was taking land, wealth, and labor from indigenous people, leading to their near extermination in this hemisphere, in terms of some groups. And two, the transatlantic slave trade, which created a racial underclass. Two phenomena that so profoundly changed the history of the world, and especially the Americas. And as you recall from, because we all learned about Columbus, especially those of us in U.S. schools learned a particular view of Columbus, which I'll talk about. Columbus, of course, encountered Indians, called them Indians, the Arawak, the Taino, who had profoundly different societies than the one that he came from. They held economic resources in common. They were essentially communists with a small c. And their communal existence conflicted dramatically with the avarice and individualism of Columbus and his men, and of course, the conquistadores who came after. I'm arguing, as I go through Zinn's material, I'm trying to take loads of other material to add to it, that I'm arguing that essentially this was a clash, it was a cultural clash, but it was a conflict over how the means of life would be organized and distributed, essentially privately or communally. And this is a conflict that is still with us. And in 1877, Chief Sitting Bull, when he referred to the Europeans, addressed this conflict, and I quote, "The love of possession is a disease with them." He was referring to Europeans. "These people have made many rules that the rich may break, but the poor may not." Religion, of course, was intimately involved in this cultural clash, and specifically at first Catholicism, which was used by Columbus and those who followed to justify exploitation and slavery. The Protestants would be not far behind, especially in the northeastern United States, and would join in. Even Columbus's admiring biographer, Samuel Eliot Morison, a rear admiral in World War II, the preeminent biographer of Christopher Columbus, major American historian. In fact, his book, Morison and Commager, was the book I remember reading for an entire year as an undergraduate freshman at the University of Rochester. Even Morison admits that genocide occurred because of Columbus's voyages and subsequent movements of European explorers to the United States in what is now the United States. This, of course, is a word that was not used in my education all the way through high school and also as an undergraduate history major, and really was not a word that came upon the scene till I began to reread and rework some of these materials in graduate school. And I think it's a word that we were not taught to use because, in a sense, we were taught in schools and by the mass media to essentially take the victimizers and the exploiters' side, not the victims. We were taught that by teachers, by clergy, by the mass media, and of course you've read the chapter, so you know that Zinn challenges this view. These atrocities that occurred centuries ago didn't just disappear and end. They commenced with Columbus in terms of the European and America's clash and have continued certainly over the last century. When you think of direct and indirect U.S. actions in El Salvador, in Brazil, in Chile, in Guatemala, in Haiti, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, Grenada, Nicaragua, Guyana, Panama, and Cuba, among others. In fact, I don't think there's actually a nation south of the Rio Grande that the United States has not invaded or attempted to overthrow. It's an incredibly sorry record. And the record's clear, by the way. The evidence is indisputable and overwhelming. The only debate is why this has happened. The Columbus assault on the Americas was also shaped and supported by religious leaders. That is, the conquest of the Americas, who essentially lauded liberty and God and supported racism and terror. And Columbus was merely, in many ways, the first, but not the only European conqueror to use religion to rationalize conquest. It was divinely ordained by God. And since we were rarely taught to think critically about these issues, however, we did not link Columbus and the rise of Europe to religious beliefs, domination, and exploitation. In a sense, the Columbus narrative, the one we're familiar with, the one I learned in schools, and in one way or another we all learned in U.S. schools, is a struggle of two contesting views of America's past, the present and the future. And I would argue that it's difficult to confront Columbus's legacy because, not just because of our lack of critical historical knowledge, but also because in confronting Columbus, I would argue that essentially we're confronting an abusive father figure in our own home. Columbus is our, in many ways, Columbus is the father of America or the United States, not Washington. So when we look at history, it's easy to condemn Hitler or Stalin or Idi Amin, people far away in time and place. Now, Columbus is far away in time, but essentially when we think of Columbus because of so many things that he represents, and so many towns and so many high schools named Columbus High School and hospitals, etc., what we're really doing is taking our critique of injustice to the kitchen table and looking across the table at this great hero. And that's hard, okay? It's very hard. Columbus, of course, is honored with a national holiday, though the national holiday is not celebrated in every state in the United States. There are states that actually have a much more resistant idea of that day, South Dakota being one of them. But Columbus is honored. When you think of national holidays, you think of four figures. You think of Columbus, Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, and George Washington. Columbus, of course, is America's first great hero. So you have four American heroes honored with holidays. One was a slave trader and a conqueror. One was a slave owner and an Indian killer. You really look at George Washington's career quite carefully. One freed the slaves but did not believe in equality between the races, Lincoln. And one, Martin Luther King, was the descendant of slaves who struggled against racism, economic exploitation, and militarism, and who gave his life in that struggle. Now, despite the actual brutal historical record, which we have, I mean, we have Columbus's own logs. We have the writings of Las Casas, the missionary, who was on some of these trips, who then became the Bishop of Mexico. We have eyewitness reports over hundreds of years. There's still people, mainstream people, who regard Columbus as a worthy character model. One columnist even wrote that to denigrate Columbus is to denigrate what is worthy in human history and in us all. How touching. One of the books on the reading list is called American Holocaust. Historian David Stannard, who's at the University of Hawaii, points out that from the first contact, pestilence and purposeful genocide destroyed American natives and drove countless numbers of ancient societies to the brink and often over the brink of total extermination. The ongoing violence elicited resistance from natives from the beginning. That resistance, I would argue, continues in the Americas. It's more than 500 years. And I will argue, and Stannard argues, that this violence and struggle will persist until we understand the magnitude and the causes of destruction begun with Columbus on October 12, 1492. Now, the destruction continued with other Spanish conquistadores. For example, each time the Spaniards encountered a native group, they ordered the natives to read a statement informing them of the truth of Christianity and the necessity to swear allegiance to the Pope and to the Spanish crown. If they resisted, the Spaniards stated that, quote, with the help of God, we shall enter your country and shall make war against you and shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and their highnesses. We shall take your wives and children and shall make slaves of them. And that's exactly what happened with Columbus and others. Spain finally apologized for its actions on October 12, 1992, on one of the decks of either the Nina, Pinta, or Santa Maria. Replicas of those ships had been built and sailed to the United States, and they had a ceremony in which many people of the Americas met in New York, and representatives of Spain met with representatives of indigenous peoples, and a number of people that I know from the American Indian Program at Cornell University were on one of those ships. There was a major international conference in Ithaca, New York, the week just prior to October 12th, and then they took a bunch of people on buses to New York and had this incredibly, according to friends who were there, incredibly moving ceremony. And it was 500 years too late, but there was an expression that we must live in the Americas and elsewhere in harmony with each other and, of course, with Mother Earth. To date, at least to my knowledge, the U.S. government has never formally apologized for its genocidal actions against the original Americans on what is now the continental United States and beyond. Spanish sadism was legion and openly reported in the logs of Columbus, as in quotes, and in others, including De las Casas, who has documented the cruelties inflicted upon the Indians. The facts of this terror are in the public record. They're indisputable. They cannot be denied. They were Nazi-like in character, but they have never, at least in the United States, in the continental United States, they have never elicited the level of outrage used to condemn the Nazis. And I'm going to talk about that because Stannard makes a very interesting argument. He argues that the reason for the difference in the level of outrage is that our reaction to violence is often shaped by the nature of the victims, not by the crimes themselves. It's who gets killed and who gets oppressed that often shapes our outrage. Some people are more worthy of outrage than others. So that terror, the actual facts, are filtered through a belief system, a previous belief system, that often does not rest on the principled objection to violence. It's a selective objection to violence. So, of course, many of us, I mean, I remember growing up, and that all we learned about was the barbaric Indians, and they did this, and they did that, and we never really understood the context. So the terror against American Indians, Native Americans, indigenous people, for example, does not warrant the outrage that many of us have felt about the horrors inflicted upon European Jews during the Holocaust. That's Stannard's argument. We learn about the Holocaust, as we should, as every person, child in this society should, to remember exactly what happened. But we learn very little, and many of us learn very little, about the Native Holocaust here in the Americas. And even within the European Holocaust, there's a ranking system of victims. We learn, again, as we should, because they were the primary victims, about Jews in Europe, but many of us learn virtually nothing about homosexuals, the mentally ill, and the Roma, gypsies, who were also targeted and destroyed by the SS and other aspects of the Third Reich. Now, what happened in the continental United States, which essentially was a genocidal attack on Native Americans, often referred to as Indian removal, was an attack on lives, on culture, on land, and even animals. such as the buffalo, millions of which were slaughtered by whites in literally an orgy of violence on the Great Plains. One of the great, you know, catastrophes facing Native Americans. So a great tragedy unfolded against those who had an intimate and sacred connection to nature, who were destroyed by those who claimed to be doing it for God and transcendent spiritual values. So the fun, and as we look at this, it seems to me that the fundamental beliefs of Christianity are central to this tragedy. They must be part, our critical understanding of the role of religion and the role especially of Christianity. This was not done by Jews and Buddhists and Muslims. That must be part of any critical historical inquiry in the clash between Christian Europeans and indigenous peoples here. And in a sense, it's a clash that involves, and this is something Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz's article will get into, that is, when she discusses the origin story of Ulster Scots Christians who were the settlers and colonizers of Northern Ireland, and then the Appalachians of North America. That becomes the origin story that we learn as Americans in our textbooks. And we learned about the Pilgrims especially, and again, speaking as someone who was schooled in the Northeast, we learned about the Pilgrims, the Puritans, we learned about New England. We didn't learn anything about the Spaniards in Florida and what was going on in the South, what is now the Southwest and California. So the settlers came, they did God's will, they forged the Promised Land. Of course, the Promised Land was empty, it was barren. You would read that in earlier history books. I mean, there was no one here, of course. So why not take over this place? They forged the Promised Land, and of course, they were surrounded by savages, and they had to kill the heathen. First, of course, they killed lots of Irish in what is now Northern Ireland, and then Native Americans. What happened to Native Americans in what is now the continental United States? The British actually practiced on the Irish for a few hundred years in terms of search and destroy missions, burning villages, killing people. They didn't just start it here in the United States. So you have a founding of America, in a sense, following the critical Columbus narrative, a founding of America essentially on behalf of propertied, mostly slave-owning white males who formed a settler, colonialist, and imperialist aggressor state whose genocide and confiscation of the land they essentially confiscated the land of those who were here. And Stannard and others argue that it was during the era of Jacksonian democracy in the 1820s and 30s, the early 19th century, that the unique U.S. origin myth was created, one that comes down to us in textbooks and in films and in stories that we later learn. With the initial scribe, the most important writer of this origin story, James Fenimore Cooper, Cooperstown, New York. Baseball Hall of Fame, okay, the Fenimore Cooper House. He literally invented America in The Last of the Mohegans, which a number of scholars argue becomes the official U.S. origin story. Fenimore Cooper was the great hero of Walt Whitman, who sang the song of manhood and America. And essentially, it was an America of empire. I love Whitman's poetry. He moved generations with his poetry. I actually have a wonderful, somehow my father had two cloth-bound editions of Whitman's poetry with marvelous, marvelous sketches in them. At the same time, Whitman was an enthusiastic supporter, for example, of the U.S. war against Mexico, and he followed the already established U.S. origin myth that had frontier settlers replacing Native peoples, in many ways very similar, a parallel process that went on with the Afrikaner myth in South Africa. The early development of South Africa by whites and the early development in the United States by whites very, very similar. And it created a white supremacist ideology that formed the core of U.S. policy from the origins to the present. Standard argues that, not just Standard, but other scholars, that Europeans conquered Americans because they waged unpremeditated biological warfare against people who were thought to be uncivilized. It wasn't just unpremeditated. There were some certainly premeditated examples. One of them, Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who had smallpox-infected blankets actually given over to the Indians in what is now Massachusetts. The city of Amherst, Massachusetts, is named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst, as is Amherst College. And having spent time there, it's interesting, I don't recall any massive effort to change the name of the college or the town. So you have people were thought to be uncivilized and destroyed. But indigenous peoples were clearly civilized, if by that we mean having a noble religion and philosophy, original arts, stirring music, rich stories, and legend. They, of course, were civilized. And history tells us that the civilized societies that we learned about, that meant Europe, white Europeans from Northern and Western Europe, with whom we are taught to admire, are likely to resort to savage violence in their attempts to conquer primitive or uncivilized peoples. Columbus, the Spaniards, the English pacification, the conquest of the Irish, etc. It's a long and very, very tragic story. And this long history in the United States, in what is now the United States, was marked by one long war with Indians that began in the early 17th century New England in what is now Massachusetts and essentially ended about 300 years later with the 1890 massacre at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, when some 350 unarmed Lakota, mostly women, children, and old men, were killed. Among the prominent citizens supporting and even advocating genocide against Native Americans, and this absolutely blew my mind when I discovered this in research, was none other than L. Frank Baum, the author of the much beloved Wizard of Oz, who grew up in Chittenango, New York, not far from where I used to live. He moved out to South Dakota. He was editor of the Aberdeen Pioneer at the time of Wounded Knee. Before the massacre, he stated that, quote, "The nobility of the redskin is extinguished, and what few are left are a pack of whining curs who lick the hand that smites them. The whites, by law of conquest, by civilization, are masters of the American continent, and the best safety of the frontier settlements will be secured by the total annihilation of the few remaining Indians." After the massacre, Baum wrote that, quote, "We had better, in order to protect our civilization, follow it up and wipe these untamed and untamable creatures from the face of the earth." Now, I'm still a fan of, that movie. I don't know how many times I've seen it with my kids when they were growing up. But wow, I keep asking, where was the Good Witch of the West when the Lakota needed her? Incredible. And there's a little plaque. There's a little plaque to L. Frank Baum when you drive into Chittenango, New York, near Syracuse, not far from Syracuse. And I wonder what the kids at the local high school learned about Baum. This long, tragic tale, beginning with Columbus and the Caribbean, of course, comes across the United States and comes here to California. The Spaniards remarked that when they came to California, what is now California, they found Indian societies with remarkably egalitarian and democratically ordered cultures. The explorers described the Santa Barbara or Channel Islands in the mid-1500s with many Indians who greeted them in friendship and treated with ceremonies of peace, which, of course, as with the Taino that Columbus met, whom he described as the most amazing, gentle, beautiful people. This interaction, of course, then he went on to kill them and enslave them. These interactions ought to really cause us to question sort of this socio-biologistic notion of human nature that people are inherently evil and violent. Because you got two people coming together, and one group was actually quite wonderful, gentle, and beautiful, and the other group wasn't. So if this is a genetic thing, I mean, somebody had some genetic problems here. We're talking about a socialized culture. In California, as elsewhere, of course, in the United States, disease and cruelty took a huge toll among the Indians, and part of it, tragically, and again this gets us back to religion, was the result of brutal conditions in Jesuit and Franciscan missions in this state that are all over the state. I mean, we can still visit them. The Franciscans starved and worked their would-be converts to death, while the diseases they and others had imported killed off thousands more, similar to the slave labor camps that the Spaniards ran in Central and South America. With the best theological intentions, I mean, it's always done for people's good, okay? The Franciscans eliminated Indians with the effectiveness of Nazis operating concentration camps, as the missions along the coast of California might best be described as picturesque charnel houses. It was the mission experience that truly decimated the Indians of California. They were strictly regimented and disciplined in these missions and essentially became slaves. The legend, of course, and again, think of films, think of what we learned, is that the missionaries, the Franciscans, etc., were gentle and mild. And some, of course, were, who really believed in what would be, let's say, a generous or a general understanding of what people, when they think of Jesus, you know, people ask. Actually, a question that ought to be asked a lot about people today. You know, would Jesus be running this kind of camp for Indians here in this mission? So there were some, of course, who were gentle and mild. But the historical record, again, we have the records, because we're talking into the mid-19th century here. The record reveals brutal conditions and harsh punishments. And, of course, in the process, the holdings for the Franciscans were quite extensive, ending up owning thousands of Indians' cattle, horses, and sheep, having huge estates. At the time of the American conquest of California and the development of California as a state, one scholar argues there were about 72,000 Native Americans left out of perhaps 300,000 who were here when the Spaniards first came. By 1865, this number dropped to 15,000.